Okay, welcome back. Hour number two. All kinds of things going on in the background and in the front. We're right there watching this thing day after day after day, as are many of you. There's a lot of denial out there. That's the big secret. That's how people get away from reality. They just deny it. No, it's not true. And one of the most obvious cases of denial of reality is this internet-wide fake graphene oxide did it, rumor, story. People are taking positions on this all the time now. It's the graphene oxide. It's the big villain. Well, it's not. Graphene oxide is not the villain. N-O-T. It's not. So the denial leads to ease of misdirecting and redirecting the sheeple into whatever cul-de-sac the controllers want. And this whole graphene oxide thing has been one of the prime examples of that. Now, we've watched this for several months, many months. Actually, it's had two incarnations, if I remember correctly. It kind of came on the scene, and then it went away. And they ran through several other scenarios, almost equally as stupid. And then they brought back graphene oxide, but with more clout and more oversight than before. Welcome back, Erica.
Thank you, Jeff. Nice to be here.
Was I correct?
100%.
So they're running wild with this thing now, and people are saying, that's it. That they're not questioning anything. And I honestly don't see any way to get these people back to reality. We can't. All we can do is just keep telling it as it is, telling it as logically and pragmatically as we can, and hoping that a few will figure it out. But we do have a couple good stories. Ivermectin and other treatments for cancer is going up in headlines momentarily. That's a good one. Dr. Russell Blaylock is the subject of another good story. Neurosurgeon proves how COVID vaccine can damage the brain and cause cancer, among many, many other things. We need to keep in mind at all times that that is not a vaccine. Don't get tricked by the word. It's not. It is a biological weapon owned by the Pentagon and created physically by Moderna and Pfizer, most obviously. And other companies are involved, too. The AstraZeneca was horrific. The Johnson & Johnson, just as bad. But they sort of faded away. First J&J, I think it was, and then AZ, but whatever. We've got Pfizer and Moderna. And many of you maybe have seen that video of Big Al Borla on a walk at the Davos get-together. He went outside the boundaries and was pounced on by an independent journalist crew from Canada, Rebel News. And they asked him a bunch of questions, and he didn't answer any of them. He just kept walking and was led by a lady with him to a apparently safety at the end of their walk. But it was funny to watch somebody ill at ease when they usually talk with such conviction and power. And boy, that guy is a funny-looking fellow. I'll leave it at that. He's strange. You remember the neck-breathing videos of him, I think most of you. He's an odd one. Wouldn't surprise me if he were a hybrid, so to speak.
Mm. Oh, they're all odd-looking, let's put it that way. All of those that are in charge of those pharmaceutical companies right now, they all have a distinct appearance to them.
Why is that? They are.
I don't know.
It's
uncanny. It's uncanny.
It's very suspect. Look, I don't have the answers, but I do have the questions, and one of them would be, is it possible that there is an ET hybrid of human and reptilian? And the answer, who knows what the answer is. But I would say that Borla and Stefan Bancel of Moderna are, if you look at them, they don't look like us. They look different.
Well, and we have the other couple there, the BioNTech.
Oh, there's more, but I just picked those as the most obvious. Yeah.
You know, I don't see one of us when I look at them. There's something distinctly different about them.
Nicely said. I don't see us either when I look at them. And if you look at those videos of Big Al's neck moving in and out like a lizard or a snake, you just say, what the hell is going on here? Because my neck, I couldn't do that with my neck if I had to. Anyway, okay, we have another week that has passed. What's different at the end of this week than when we started out Monday? Anything you can put your finger on? Where are we here? What's changed? If anything has changed, or are things just becoming more obvious and more intense, i.e. shedding and the bivalent booster, which appears to be able to cause people to produce even more spike and maybe more mRNA, and both of those, and I underline that, both of those are being shed. So it used to be we thought that if you're out and about and you're mixing and mingling, you're going to get spiked. Well, now you may get mRNA'd as well, and if you do, you might as well have had the vax. Maybe not in number, but the mechanism is there, the mRNA. It'll go into your body. If someone exhales in your face and you inhale it, you're going to probably get, if they're shot up, you're going to get the mRNA on the spike, and the mRNA goes into your body's cells and turns them into little spike factories. That's not what you want. If you get spike alone, that's a challenge for your immune system. But if you get mRNA'd, you basically have gotten vaxxed. It may be on a smaller scale, but you have gotten vaxxed. That's what the vax does, among other things.
I think that that has been ongoing from the beginning. I mean, some of these people last year, after it rolled out and before we were really aware that this was happening, some people have got very, very sick after being around the vax, and they were hospitalized, and many of them were subsequently diagnosed with COVID, which means they had, you know, when they do the test for it, they're not looking for spike. They're looking for the nucleocapsid, a nucleotide sequence in the nucleocapsid. So that's more than just spike protein. That's the actual evidence of the actual viral infection.
Right.
So, you know, we still don't have a full picture of what's being spread. Is it just creating a susceptibility that people in, you know, a normal situation would have fought off the virus, wouldn't have been a problem, but now they've got spike poisoning, so now they have an increased susceptibility to becoming infected to the virus. That may be happening. The trend lately now is that many people who were able to withstand shedding now are developing an intolerance to it. They too are succumbing to illness. Some seriously, some just, you know, annoyingly, but nonetheless, in general, the shedding appears to be worse unless something different is being shed. That's a possibility
right.
too.
Well, we're seeing the shed upon dying. These
in some
people
cases,
are,
yes.
they're dying. Not a
yes.
lot, at least not. We shouldn't even say that because we don't know. All we have are the anecdotal reports put into the social media groups. The government's not going to tell us, no chance. So we
right.
try and track it. We try and balance out what's likely, what's unlikely. And in all likelihood, there are a number of people, maybe a lot of people, who are becoming so wounded and injured by shedding that they are, in fact, dying. Some of the stories are, we've read them, you've heard them, they're horrific. So I think, on balance, if I had to project, the shedding issue is getting to be worse and more pathological. And whatever efforts you make are well worth it. I don't care what they are. Masks, distance, go to the store in the morning or late at night. Well, late at night it'd be full of spike proteins, but go early perhaps. It's a very tricky situation, especially when you're talking about family, loved ones, friends, co-workers. It's tough. And they knew this. They played this, the whole thing out in computer-simulated gaming for years and years, maybe decades. They knew how people would react, and they knew that they're, I call it the last act, but it's not the last act, but shedding is the last act. It's part three of this three-act play. First was the virus, then was the vax, and now we have shedding. And shedding is being counted upon by them to clean up the 10, 20, or 30% who don't get the shots. They're going to get them one way or the other, and shedding is the answer. At least that's how we see it.
Yeah, and this was known, and it is kind of funny to watch some of these doctors come out and pretend as if they're surprised. Well, this wasn't supposed to happen.
Oh, please.
It was written about more than a couple times since probably, I would say, 2005 maybe, when they started experimenting with these vector-based vaccines.
Right. Okay, well, what we're seeing now across the country are hospitals reporting that they're beyond capacity. They don't know what to do. They've got people in the halls on gurneys. They've got no beds available. And even if they do have the beds available, many of the hospitals no longer have the staff to take care of the patient in the bed. They really don't. Now, we've been blessed on this program to have a tremendously talented, graceful woman who's been a professional nurse for well over 30 years. I don't want to tell you how old she is, but she's been at it a long time. Nothing fools her. And she is Nurse Anne, and she's back with us tonight. A lovely Irish lass. Hello, Nurse Anne, and welcome back.
Well, I don't know what to say after such a wonderful greeting. It's great to be back.
Well, here's a little treat for you. We have a wonderful Irish nurse on. And the other pretty lady here is also a little Irish. So there. Here.
Oh, wonderful.
This is for
Hello,
both
Erica,
of you.
Hello, Erica. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
All right.
I'm doing
here,
great.
This is for both of you.
My wild Irish rose, the sweetest flower that grows. You may search everywhere, but none can compare with my wild Irish rose.
All right, that's enough. That's all you get, but we want you to feel...
Oh, pitter-patter. My heart is racing now.
I want to say something. If everybody remembers the airline pilot... from Australia, Graham Hood. He was mandated by his employer to take the jab, and of course he refused. And he made a short video well over a year ago that he was I don't care how much time I have invested, I'm not taking an experimental vaccine. And yeah. He made a pretty good stink about it, and his statements went viral. And I had wondered what happened to him. Turns out he has his own podcast. It's on Rumble, and I think it's on other venues as well. But anyway, he had a program on January 12th with a couple other people. He picked some really interesting guests to kind of, bitch and complain about. And the topic of Irish nurses came up. And it was really quite flattering what they said about Irish nurses. Apparently, they have a reputation of being... very qualified, very competent and qualified, but also very, very tough.
Yeah.
So consider yourself lucky to get an Irish nurse.
The training is different. Yeah, the training is very different in Europe in that, it's changed now, but when I was coming up in the ranks, you were trained in the hospitals. So when you wanted to become a nurse, you went from what would be the equivalent of high school here. You'd go to, if you wanted to become a nurse, you were going right to the hospital. And from there, you would be trained actually in the hospital. And you would spend a number of your years studying and learning, and you would be in the job. And what used to happen is they'd find out very quickly who was able to handle the job and who wasn't.
Mm.
And that was a way to filter out the people who would not actually make really good nurses. But...
Right.
They did work you. I mean, they worked you like a dog, and you got paid though, which was kind of nice. That was when you were training in Ireland and England. Now that has since changed, and Ireland has adopted the same way of training nurses now as they do over here. In that you go to colleges now, you go on site to colleges, and then you do your clinicals in the hospital rotations that you're at while you're training. Which
one thing
is
they
a big
didn't
loss
tell you.
It's a, yeah.
I'll bet one thing they didn't tell you Anne, was you would have to be teaching doctors while you were taking care of patients.
Yeah, that is rather funny. I chuckle about that all the time. I really do.
Yeah.
When I work the ICUs, I mean, of course, the doctors have to learn too, but it's very funny because they come up to us and they're asking us, how would we order this and how would we do this or how would we proceed with that? And I'm thinking, I'm not getting paid enough here.
You know, you're not. That's no joke.
Two people's jobs.
But yeah.
Yes, it's kind of comical and funny. That's the only way I can look at it.
That's the best way to look at it. Well, that's the only way you can get by. Mm-hmm. Erica, anything you want to ask? Anne, I got a question for her. You go ahead first.
No, you go.
All right. You are at a different hospital now than you were the last time you were on the program. What can you give us just a quick thumbnail sketch how big this hospital is? I assume it's in New York as well.
Yes. Yes, it's in New York. And it's about 600 beds, so it's a relatively big hospital.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of they do a lot of procedures there, the only thing they would not really do is transplants. The transplants would go somewhere else. But pretty much everything else they will do there for procedures. And it is it's the second biggest hospital in the area.
All right, very good. Now, nationally speaking, and then we'll come back to your local experiences now and since you've been there. And the last hospital you were in, I think, had 700 beds, so this is virtually the same size. But nationwide, I'm seeing stories all the time, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that hospital full, hospital overcrowded, no room, 8 to 10 hours to be seen by somebody in the ER. It's crazy. The question I have is, how much longer before these hospitals actually begin to fail, to close down? They can't do it anymore. They're not able. Are we going to see that fairly soon, do you think? A shortage of hospitals next?
In this area, I don't think they can. These hospitals won't close because before COVID ever hit, unfortunately, they closed two small area hospitals in this area and then completely closed them down before COVID ever happened. And then they also closed down a psychiatric unit too, a facility that just catered to behavioral health issues. That was completely closed down, and all of those poor people were put out into the streets to their families where they didn't know how to cope with what was going on with the patients. So we are now in a situation where it was already a problem to begin with.
Uh-huh.
Now it's just more problematic than it's ever been. So we are, the system, the hospitals that are surviving will still continue to survive for a while, Jeff. That's the thing.
Right.
Because the patients are coming in. The problem is the patients can't get to the unit. They're sitting in the ERs for days at a time, maybe a week at a time.
Really?
Gee.
Up to a week ER before they can?
Seriously. Yeah. They'll spend
all right, tell us more. Week. All right, hold on. This is very important. This is critically important because a lot of people listening may end up feeling like they've got to go to the hospital. And it sounds to me like they'd be better off staying home and using common sense unless there's something absolutely life-threatening crisis that's happening to them, and then they should call 911 and not just drive to the hospital. I don't know. What is your advice to people who may need emergency care if it's not available?
Yeah. Right. Here's my advice. The only way I can say this safely is if you're to the point where you can't breathe or you're having problems with racing with their heart, because we're seeing a ton of atrial fibrillation at the moment, and people who never had it now have it. So this is key because there's young and old people coming in with other problems, and when they're getting the workups, they're finding atrial fib. and that everybody I've seen in this unit that I'm working on has a fib. So that was a red
and
flag
everyone,
when I came this time.
I would suggest that they're all vaxxed as well, correct?
All vaxxed, 100%, mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. vaxxed. So the thing is if you can't breathe and you're struggling with your heart's racing, you may end up having to go to some form of an urgent care center, at a bare minimum. They can actually treat you on an outpatient basis, and based on what their findings are, they could do the blood work, and then they can determine if you really need to go to the emergency room. But I would only go to the emergency room for those two reasons. Because you're going to be sitting in the ER because for days and weeks, at least a week, where we are, there's a lot of people sitting in the ER for a week at a time. They have actually created holding areas in the ER where there are actually patients who are physically admitted to the hospital, but they cannot get a bed in any of the units, never mind ICU or step down or telemetry. You're right. Sitting there on a monitor, and now they have an ED nurse who's designated to take care of you as if you were a patient on a regular unit.
Right.
And that's how they're coping.
Are people starting to die in the ER waiting to be seen yet? Is that happening?
Oh, yeah. We have. You'll hear the codes overhead. Like, people are actually cooked. People are coding in the ER while they're waiting to be triaged.
Wow. Did you hear what she said, everyone? I hope you heard that. She said they're waiting in the ER and some are dying while they're waiting for what? To be seen and treated properly and admitted properly and put in a bed? No. They're waiting to be seen and triaged. You have to understand. This is not medicine and modern hospitalization as we used to know it. It's all different now. Wow.
This is no fault of the medical field as such. It's just the enormity of what we're dealing with the level of sick population we have now. And it's
right.
across the board. I mean, we're seeing so many young people, and we're seeing so many middle-aged and adults. And they're all coming in. It's all chronic. It's all chronic issues now. And acutely ill events like the atrial fibrillation, which is something they would never have had, or they're having problems. They're coming in for problems with migraines, and all of a sudden they're finding that you have a brain tumor. They're having a problem with their heart, and they're getting short of breath, and all of a sudden they're finding that they're in CHF, which is congestive heart failure, or they're finding that when they do the workups, they're finding that their arteries are completely clotted, and so they're being brought down for procedures. But those are the lucky ones that actually get to actually have that actually done. Just
right.
to get past the ER doors is even tricky at this point.
Wow. Okay. Clots. Are we seeing mostly amyloid clots that you know of that are being removed? Is anyone talking about that now, or are they sometimes blood clots? They're two different things, dear listeners. You all know it, and I'm just curious. I haven't heard the word amyloid spoken now for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, four. I don't know. It's been a while. It seems to have been, that's what it is, and they filed it away. It's not in the media anymore. I mean, the alt media. Certainly not in the mainstream media very often. What are we getting clot-wise?
Yeah.
What are you hearing?
Well, from the unit that I'm on now, so this is a break-off unit of the emergency department, so just so you know. So what they've created a medical observation unit. So the people that they're trying to get through the doors, and the ER section is full with the patients that one nurse can accommodate. They're sending them to the medical observation unit so that the nurses on this unit, which are myself and a bunch of other nurses included, are taking care of these patients while they're waiting to be sent somewhere else. So what's happening is this should have been a very simplified situation. When they created this unit, they thought, oh, you know, this is going to be make things to transition easy for the patients, where they're going to go within the hospital, or if they're going to get better and go to rehab, or if they're going to get better and possibly maybe go home. Here's the problem. Where the population is too sick now, so we're getting patients. Like, I've already, this week I've already had two patients come through this unit that are true cardiac step-down, maybe even ICU patients at this point. And right. So I'm going to the providers and saying, these people are really, really sick and they shouldn't be in this unit. They need to go to a higher level of care. So I'm arguing with providers now about the fact that they're taking on these types of patients that shouldn't actually be here. These are only supposed to be here for a max between 24 and 48 hours, and we're having patients holding them for a week. There's maybe two, and no, that wasn't the way this unit was set up to be. It was an extension of the emergency department.
So they just go, they're put in a bed, and they'll be in that mm-hmm. bed waiting for some kind of a decision to be made for up to a week. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily the decision. It's how they present. So, for example, this lady came in, and she presented having abdominal pain. And right. We've seen a couple of, quite a few cases of abdominal pain. Well, lo and behold, what happened was that she said she was in the parking lot packing her groceries in the car. She passed out. The lights went out. She didn't know what happened. All of a sudden, she was on the ground. Well, come to find out, she was in atrial fibrillation with rapid ventricular rhythm. So her heart rate was running a mile a minute, and her heart rate was in the 150s to 180s. So that's what made her pass out.
I see.
So she's brought to the hospital. So she's saying she's complaining of abdominal pain. They put her on a heart monitor, and there you go. Everybody's in panic mode. And they're asking her if she has any heart problems or heart, no heart history whatsoever. No history of hypertension, none in the family. Is she on anticoagulation? Nothing like that. And were you vaccinated? Yes, I've got all of my 5 vaccinations. Boom.
I'm fully vaxxed. Don't worry. I'm up to date. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then you
can basically, you could basically write the end of the story, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. As soon as that question is asked and answered, there you go. Mm-hmm. There's your problem identified, reason why you're here.
Wow.
Is there any more, I guess, awareness of the medical staff that this is the reason why these, you know, the emergency room is overrun with people now?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I ran into a situation. So in the emergency department, they're supposed to come in, Erica, and then they do these COVID swabs on the PCR still and whatever.
Are these nasal swabs?
Still doing them. And sometimes they'll do the sputum, but mostly nasal. They're doing that, and so they have to determine that they're negative, they're COVID negative, before they can send them anywhere within the hospital. But the ER is getting so inundated with patients, they're sending them up to the floors and to the observation unit where I'm at the moment, or so sooner than before the results of the test come back. So they sent up a patient to this unit, and one of the nurse's aides was, she was pregnant, and she was in and out of this room for about 4 solitary hours, and like nobody had actually come back and told us the results of that COVID patient, that test on that patient. And then, boom, 4 hours later, comes back positive. Now, this poor nurse had been in and out of nurse's aide had been in and out of that room all night, all for those 4 hours. She's pregnant with her first child. So, of course, she's very distressed by the whole thing now, because she's really annoyed that they sent the patient up before the test results were in. And, mm-hmm. and she was getting really upset about it. And I pulled her aside and I said, listen, you shouldn't actually worry about the fact that that test is COVID positive. What I'd be more worried about is how many vaccines that person had.
Yeah. Yes.
And her eyes just deer in the headlights.
No, they don't have a clue.
Yeah.
No, they don't have a clue. No, I've had all my shots. I should be safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. Wow.
I mean, I said to her, I mean, I told you, I mean, when I was in the thick of the ICU, when it was all COVID back then, when we first came up on COVID in 2019, 2020, I was working the ICU all the time then. And I swear, the amount of times that people were trying to pull out, they'd wake up from the anesthesia and the sedation, and what they would do is try and go for that tube and pull the try and extubate themselves from the ventilator. And the amount of times I had no time to put on any gear, I'd run into the room, and they'd already have the they'd already have pulled the tube out. The alarms are going like crazy, and you know, everything's going nuts. Everybody's running in. Nobody's masked at this time because nobody has time to put stuff on, and you're trying to basically stabilize the patient. I'm just saying that happened more than once, and I'm telling you, I got exposed more than once, and I've never had COVID. Never.
Well, most of those cases, as we know now, were at least half of them were influenza. Mm-hmm. Misdiagnosed. They had to have the numbers. They had to have sick people. And the normal 50 plus million cases of influenza a year supposedly dropped down to 3,000 cases. Well, where did the 50 million cases of influenza go?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I would agree.
They didn't go anywhere. They just relabeled them COVID, put them on remdesivir, shut their kidneys down, filled their lungs with fluid, put them on a vent, and then rolled them out the back door in a body bag. That was it. Done. That's how they killed so many people.
They progressively got worse when they were put on remdesivir. I mean, classically, the system started to fail, and they call that multiple system organ failure. Right. And that's classic. It was classic what was happening until we actually started treating them with ivermectin. And then all of a sudden, no, you can't use ivermectin. And all they came in and they cleaned that hospital out of their ivermectin stock. Now, where that ivermectin stock went to, God only knows. But I will tell you, it's gold dust for whoever has it now.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Now, this is fascinating. So your hospital began to use ivermectin to treat either it was influenza or the actual virus, whatever. They used ivermectin. What were the results you were seeing with ivermectin before they took it away?
We were actually seeing people turn around. They had started them on remdesivir, and they had gotten a couple of doses of remdesivir, and then they started to bring on the ivermectin. And that's kudos to the infectious disease doctors. Well done for them. I pat them on the back. In that hospital, they did a great job. So, but then apparently the FDA said it was no longer going to be approved as an approved use for treating COVID.
Yeah.
And it was sent out, masses of information was sent to the hospital administrators, and that was fed down to the physicians who were basically being told how to practice, by the way. And I have never understood this, that you spend your lifetime, you mean 30 or 40 years of your life, working towards becoming a physician, only to be told how you're going to practice now. I'd have a little bit of a problem with that if I was them.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So the word got out that your particular hospital and obviously many others were beginning to use ivermectin because it works. Okay, and to turn somebody around after they've been poisoned or toxified with remdesivir, a couple of doses of that is saying even more for ivermectin. I don't say definitely interfaced with the remdesivir, but it certainly turned somebody around who had been given what amounts to a preliminary death sentence because of the treatment. You can't. Mm-hmm. Remdesivir is a cold, flat-out cold killer. Simple. That's amazing. So who came in to take the ivermectin out of the hospital? Do you remember? Or was the hospital just ordered to gather its stock up and turn it over to somebody?
Yeah, the order came from administration that all stocks on the unit had to be boxed up, and that pharmacy would be coming up, pick up all of the supplies, and then
Then
pharmacy was to turn it over to I don't know who, but
Nobel Prize winner developed ivermectin. Largely acknowledged to be one of the safest pharmaceuticals ever made available to treat disease like that. And it is still to this day, I guess, being stepped on. Are you seeing any of it being used in your hospital at all? And ivermectin, don't just think about it in terms of treating COVID. It's apparently quite effective on influenza and other issues as well. It's a remarkable breakthrough in drugs.
Yeah, no, there's nobody using it now. The problem is ivermectin was completely removed once remdesivir was mandated as a protocol to use.
See? That's mass murder. Excuse me, I'm talking for myself.
And the physicians won't go outside of the box, and I don't understand that because, okay, I do. There's a few of them that the people who actually made a turnaround, those physicians said, the people, they're seeing progress in the people. So kudos to them in many ways. They said they were going to continue to use the treatment regime. So there was only the supply kept for those patients. The rest of the supplies were taken away.
I see.
But yes, we had a lady in our unit for a year, a whole year. And she had got bunches of a number of doses of remdesivir before they tried the ivermectin. And they brought her back. That lady walked out of the hospital with her family. And that took a year. But she's the only one that I can actually speak to on that fact that I saw her walk out. The others turned around, but they ended up going to rehab and subacute facilities and things like that. They didn't necessarily go home, but they left the hospital.
Wow. All right. What's going on right now at your new job, your new post? Is there anything different that you're seeing by way of trends from the last hospital? Are things changing? Are we seeing more of this, more of that?
There's one big thing that's really sticking out. And I mean, I worked cardiac step down, and I worked the ICUs and stuff like that. And we would see a mixed bag of situations where you'd have like a lot of arrhythmias, like you could have somebody who's in a junctional rhythm, and I know this is probably over everybody's head, but it's a type of a cardiac arrhythmia, okay? And or they're bradycardic or they're tachycardic or whatever, so meaning their heart rate is too slow or their heart rate is too fast. But this time around, everybody has atrial fibrillation. And the reason I speak about atrial fibrillation is, and this is key, is atrial fibrillation is not to be taken lightly. It actually is an arrhythmia that we usually treat you with anticoagulations. Okay, so if you've got the vaccine, that anticoagulation therapy isn't doing squat for you. That's number one. Mm-hmm. So just be ready. So the next thing is when you're in atrial fib, what happens is it causes your top chambers of your heart to not function correctly. And what's happening is your atria is quivering rather than pumping. So it's quivering and it's allowing the blood to pool to basically form a clot. And then the clot, once it's formed, it can go anywhere with it. It can go to your brain. It can go to your lungs. It can go a number of different places.
What is causing the heart not to beat properly? Is this part of the autonomic electrical, bioelectrical signal, beat, heart, beat, and it's being interrupted? Is that what we're seeing?
Correct. It's affecting the electrical flow of the heart. So for some reason, it has triggered the heart to not do the pumping mechanism that it should be doing. And
well,
so
Eric and I spent a good deal of time talking about how the spike protein obviously goes everywhere there's a blood flow in the body, but it goes into the brainstem, which is where this matrix of bioelectric signals goes through. It's the autonomic nervous system. And it's doing damage in there. It's microclotting in the brainstem and interrupting and interfering with bioelectric signals to the heart, among other things. Mm-hmm. Erica, anything you want to add to that? Because I think this may be part of the problem. Why so many people?
I think that could be certainly a cause of the sudden cardiac death, but I think atrial fibrillation is more of an indication that there's local damage in the heart, possibly amyloid deposits, scar tissue.
Go ahead, Ann. Go ahead.
And the thing about it is that it's becoming, in this scenario now, it's becoming more of a life-threatening situation and causing more complications for patients now that are coming in. Because
it's
before
more
we could actually acute illness or a long hospitalization. And by the way, for the rest of your life, you're on blood thinners if you're diagnosed with this. So, but to add to this, it's a huge setup for acute, sets you up for a huge increased risk of heart failure, cardiomyopathy, and stroke. So, again, when you have this going on and you know a lot, your anticoagulation therapy or treatment like Eliquis or Coumadin or something like that fails, it's probably failing because you're having AFib because it's not because of something you did necessarily or your heart did. It's probably triggered by something else, and most likely you're probably the vaccine, because any of the people I saw in this unit over the last, I think it's 2 weeks now, it runs the gamut of ages. I had the youngest was 24 years of age, and the oldest was 97. And everybody who was vaccinated, I went through those charts. Everybody was vaccinated, also had AFib. And some of them patients would have had a history for sure, like the 97-year-old lady, but the 24-year-old lady didn't. She's 24. Why would she be coming in with an AFib and chest pain?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
Well, one thing that we're watching, and Erica's seeing it first, and she informs me, is the number of younger people who are being savagely injured by these injections. Horrible issues. Endometrial cancer, hysterectomies are a dime a dozen. They're everywhere now. There's been a war declared on the reproductive rights and abilities of young women. These women are being butchered. Are you seeing, you're not in that department necessarily, but are we getting many complaints about endometrial or reproductive issues that you hear about?
There's a lot of patients coming through the ER, but they're not coming to my particular unit.
Gotcha.
When they come in for those scenarios, they'd be going to the OB unit for the most part. You know, but
that might be good to see if you can find someone there to chat with and see what's going on, because we're seeing an extraordinary number of women who are being just destroyed by this bioweapon.
Yeah.
There's a lot of miscarriages and stuff when it comes through the ER. Miscarriages, a lot of babies been born, and they're really sick. They're coding peds all the time. Young kids getting coded all the time.
Now, when you say coded, what does that mean exactly? Coded. They're getting coded.
The patient or the child is basically stopped breathing, or their heart has stopped pumping. And that,
coding means they're dead, or they're on the way to
death.
They're dead.
Yeah. They're dead. And we have to bring them back to life again. And they'll do everything for a child. I mean, they'll work on a child for easily an hour because, you know. But, you know, when you're the reality of the situation is, and people may not want to hear this, but the reality of the situation is that if your brain is over 5 minutes without oxygen, the chances of you coming back the same person are very, very slim.
Correct. Yeah. Understood. So there, yeah, if you get a chance to talk to somebody in the OBGYN end of things, that would be interesting to know what you find out. You've got your hands full. Is the hospital giving out these shots still? Is the hospital injecting people, or do they go to their GP for it, or to some?
The hospital is they are offering them. Yep. And they're asking that the question that's asked at every patient's chart when they come in. And if they don't get it, then physicians are insisting on them and getting it. And it's a real big push.
Hold on. This is very important. So if somebody goes into the hospital, not injected, one of the unvaxxed, they lean on them. In other words, we're not going to treat you unless you take this shot. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. Yeah. They're actually pushing, like they're saying, you're really sick. This is something that may continue to get worse over time. And it's progressive, like, especially with the young people. When they're seeing the young people come in that haven't been vaccinated, and they're starting to have these heart issues that they didn't have before, interestingly enough. Usually men in their 40s, if they're going to have their first, they're going to have a heart attack, it's usually in that time frame that they'll have it. And it also is contingent on their lifestyle. So we have to factor that in. How did they live their life? Did they live a clean life? If they didn't, yeah, you're right. You're kind of writing your own destiny there. But there was one guy who came in, and I don't know how they're going to manage this for payment in with the insurance companies, but he was admitted because he had abnormal labs. Now, I there isn't a patient in that hospital that doesn't have abnormal labs. But to be fair, he had high potassium levels, he had low sodium levels, he had a blood sugar of 858. He had cholesterol through the roof. His lipids were in the 400s. And of course, he never smoked and he wasn't a drinker and he never used drugs. So all of a sudden now he's now been diagnosed as a diabetic. He's got a hyperlipidemia and potential for hypertension. And they admitted him for under the diagnosis was abnormal labs. Well, I'm going to here to tell you, his insurance will never pay that because that's not an official diagnosis for starters.
So abnormal labs. In other words, the blood lab work came back abnormal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. It sounds
so
like
I told
it's
him. I said you better talk to the doctor and make sure that's changed before you're discharged because you'll end up paying that bill. The insurance won't pay it.
Do we know how many people who have not been vaxxed who are told, in no uncertain terms, unless you take this shot, we're not going to be able to help you here? How many are actually doing it, taking the shot? How many are acquiescing?
Well, in the amount of patients I saw in the past 2 weeks, and on an average night, I work 3 nights a week, and I see anywhere from 7 to 8 patients a night. And so there was only
how many patients, Anne? I'm sorry, how many a night?
So 7 to 8 patients a night I will see.
78.
7 to 7.
7 to 8. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
Yeah. And they will. Of those patients, if you average it out, when I did it, there was only 2 patients that did not have the vaccine. And it was a fight. I remember the patient, one of the patients telling me it was a fight in the ER because the doctors were insisting that she take it, get the COVID vaccine. And it, she did not want to have anything to do with it. She was a young girl, too. And so I said I admire her for standing up for what she
you
really,
bet.
Truly
well,
believed
she,
in. And,
yeah. She chose life over death. It's that mm-hmm. simple. That's simple.
Yeah.
Wow. And we're out of time already. It just flies when you come on. Take good care of yourself. Be safe in there. And we'll have you back on again whenever you're ready. Just let us know. It's always an honor.
Okay, sure thing. All right.
Yeah,
well,
good job, Ann. Thank
you. And Erica, and take care of yourself.
Okay, be safe.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, there we go. It sounds like a madhouse.
It sure does.
Crazy. I mean, strong-arming, threatening patients who are unjabbed. You take this shot or we're not going to help you? What the hell is that?
It's incredible.
It's crazy. It's
absolutely
incredible.
Incredible.
I agree. That's the word. It's incredible. And it's going on all the time, right now as we speak. Hospitals full to overflowing. I guess the state will have to step in at some point and give these hospitals money. Oh, no, excuse me. They have to contribute to the federal government so the feds can send Ukraine money. I forgot. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's over $200 billion to Ukraine now. Imagine what that would do to our medical system here. Give it strength. Underwrite knew this, knew that. Help the people of this country. No. Nope. Not going to happen. All right, well, crazy time out there, crazy time. I think the bottom line is stay away from the hospital unless, as you heard Nurse Ann suggest, she's not practicing medicine, but if you can't breathe, understood, that's one reason you should go to the hospital. But then you've got to watch out, and you need to write on your chart, no remdesivir. That's what I would suggest to anyone who would ask me. I'm not giving medical advice here. I'm just saying that's what I would say if anybody asked me. Because they're going to try. In fact, they will. They'll give it to you.
Be wary of any needles. It sounds like they're just, when you're not looking.
Oh, they could come into your if you've got a bag, they could come in any time and give you that stuff. Any time. I told you the story. No, they're not. Well, the friend of mine whom they killed in Florida made it very clear he wanted no remdesivir. And I said, you've got to get your chart. You have to get your chart and find out. Well, the doctor told me they absolutely did not give me any remdesivir. Please get your chart. He did. And he contacted me. And he said, you were right. They gave me remdesivir. Without permission. And he said, I confronted the doctor, and the doctor said, don't worry, I just gave you enough to save your life. He was dead 2 weeks later. And he only went in there with the flu. Okay, that's it for tonight. Anything you want to add? Another busy, busy hour.
Well, no, that was very enlightening.
Yeah, yeah. It's
well,
crazy.
We're lucky to have her for these frontline reports.
With her experience, not going to ever do any better than that. She's at the top of her profession.
Yep.
And Irish, too. All right,
double
young lady.
Lucky.
Yeah. Good night. See you soon.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Good night, everyone.
Okay, gang. We'll be back with... filmmaker Joel Gilbert next. We're going to talk about Michelle Obama in 2024. Don't laugh. Might happen.